All right, questions. We stopped in the middle of chapter 1 last time, so anything, questions you had?
What verse did you stop at? 10.
Verse, yeah, we finished verse 10. Okay. So if you've missed lectures and you want to catch up, they're all on the website. If you need the website, let me know. I didn't need to write anything down today, so I didn't bring out the board, but. Yes, please.
It popped in my head. I know I'm going to forget because I'm bad. Any of you that can help a little bit, because the elders aren't meeting, the chairs aren't getting moved for Wednesday night. So if any of you can just move a few, I can't stack high, and that's perfectly fine. As long as they're against the walls here and, you know, stack two or three high. Anyone, any of you, you don't have to, but if you can help with a little bit, that would be wonderful.
All right. Stack chairs. Okay, so we're in chapter 1, and if you remember the first 7 verses, right, the book starts off right where Genesis left off. The name, the Hebrew name of Exodus is actually names. Now, these are the names, okay, and names are going to be very important in the book of Exodus, especially chapter 3, where God reveals his own name, how he wants us to know him, okay? And God moved Israel to Egypt in order to fulfill the part of the Abrahamic covenant that he was going to multiply them, that they were going to be the sands of the seashore and the birds of the air, fish of the sea. Okay, so they are being fruitful and multiplying in Egypt. Okay, so why don't we, can someone read for me verses 8 through 14? We'll pick up there. Chapter 1, verse 8 through 14.
Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service, in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all of their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves."
All right, so we talked about last time that a new king arose over Egypt, probably a Moses. And if you remember, Joseph came to power when the Egyptians were in control. Then the Hyksos people took over. They were a Semitic people related to the Jews. And then Amosis was the first pharaoh that kicked them out, so he was Egyptian again. So it probably wasn't that he knew nothing about Joseph. It was just he was not going to honor anything that Joseph had done because he was afraid that the Israelites would side with who, if somebody invaded Egypt, that the Israelites would not side with Egypt but with the enemies. Okay? Remember we talked about verse 10 last week where it says, "Come, let us deal wisely," which, Joyce, what does that remind us of? You had it last week.
Tower of Babel.
Tower of Babel, right? Where they say, "Come, let us build a tower." Okay? So this refers back to Genesis 11. All right? So we know, even just from the language that Moses uses, that this is going to be trouble. This is bad. This is Satan versus God. Okay? So Pharaoh says, "Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply." All right? Back in verse 7, we're already told they're multiplying. Okay, and we talked about in our introduction that going from 70 men to 600,000 men, about 2 million people in 430 years is fast. That is big multiplication in 430 years. Okay, verse 7, it says that they're becoming exceedingly mighty, and Pharaoh recognizes that in verse 10, or in verse 9, that they are more and mightier than we. We talked a lot about last time that they probably weren't technically more than all the Egyptians or even technically mightier. Remember, they're shepherds. They don't have an army, okay? But Pharaoh is afraid of them, and he's trying to get the people of Egypt on his side. Remember, the Israelites and the Egyptians have lived peaceably together for 300 years. Right? So now this Pharaoh is trying to turn the Egyptians against the Israelites in order to so that they would persecute a people that they had lived with no problem for so long. Okay? He is afraid, end of verse 10, that they're going to fight with the enemies and depart from the land. Okay? And it's just ironic because they don't fight with his enemies, but they do depart from the land. That's exactly what they do. Okay, so that was all review from last week, verse 11. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities of Pithom and Ramses. Okay, so this is the first round. There's going to be several rounds of Pharaoh's plan, right? And this plan probably spans also several pharaohs, okay? So the first is just oppression and affliction, not even technical slavery yet. Okay, so verse 11 is, yeah, they had to do forced labor, but they weren't necessarily treated as badly as slaves are. Okay, so Pharaoh reorders their position in society. They've gone from being slaves to now hard labor. Okay. This way, if they're, you know, worn out from all this hard labor, they're going to be less of a threat to the government. He also probably thought that this might, making them do hard labor, might reduce their population. If men have to go out and work long hours, then that probably means less babies. Okay, if they don't get to spend as much time at home, then that's going to be less babies. So he is trying to reduce their population, which we're going to see all his plans. He's trying to reduce their population. Because they're being fruitful and multiplying. I mean, they're having lots of babies, and he's afraid of that. Okay. Pithom and Ramses, we're not exactly sure where these cities are. They're probably somewhere near Goshen because that's where the Israelites were. And remember, it's because the city was named Ramses that the liberals think that Ramses is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Okay. Okay. But we talked about that before, that the timeline doesn't work out with him. And even what we have recorded in Exodus, if he is the Pharaoh of when Moses was Moses was saved from the bulrushes, you know, and raised in the palace, he couldn't have been the Pharaoh of the Exodus because Exodus says that Pharaoh dies. The Pharaoh that was mad at Moses and makes Moses flee Egypt, he dies before Moses comes back. So Ramses cannot be the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Okay, and if it's the next guy down, that date is even too late for liberals to accept. Okay, so.
What did they name the storage city
Ramses? No. But remember we talked about that the name Ramses was around before Ramses the Pharaoh. It was a name that was around, just there hadn't been a Pharaoh named Ramses yet. Okay. Okay, verse 12 and 13. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. Okay, we see this often in scripture. Satan does something, and immediately God wins. It's like whatever he does, right, God turns it for good or God wins. Okay, so Pharaoh, in line with the people from the Tower of Babel, in line with Satan, he's trying to wipe out or reduce God's people. And what happens? The harder he treats them, the more babies they have. Okay? So obviously this is God at work. This is not explained by human means. Okay? So his plan backfires, and instead of decreasing in number, they increase in number. Okay, so obviously this makes no sense without God, but this is God's plan, and God is going to win regardless of what Satan or man tries to do. Okay? It says the more they spread out, right? Well, that makes sense. The more people you have, you're going to take up more land. You can't occupy the same amount of land as you did when you were smaller. Okay, so they're spreading out throughout probably all of Goshen and even maybe beyond that, okay? So they're spreading out. And then it says in verse 12, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. That dread means scared to death, Okay, so the people of Egypt are now really afraid of the Israelites because they're being treated harshly, and even so, they're still becoming greater in number and spreading out. Okay, verse 13, the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. All right, so this is round two where they're actually made slaves, and Brittany read it in ESV, and that labor rigorously that's in the NAS, in Hebrew it literally means slaves, which is how your version translated it. Can you read verse 13 for us again?
So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves.
Yes, okay. So that in the NAS, when it says labor rigorously, in the Hebrew, the literal translation is made them slaves. So the ESV is probably a better translation in that. Okay, so first they're made to work hard. That doesn't work. They increase and multiply even more. And then they're made full-on slaves, where now they have no freedom. Okay? And they're going to be, we're going to see they're treated with violence. Okay? Verse 14, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Again, labor rigorously. Rigorously imposed, it's also slaves. Okay? That word bricks, do you remember we talked about that last time? Where's the only other time in scripture we've come across the word bricks? Genesis 11, Tower of Babel. Come, let us build a tower, and they make bricks. This word is not used often, okay? So, verse 10, when Pharaoh says, come, let us, right, reminds us of Genesis 11. Now here he's having them make bricks, which reminds us of Genesis 11. Okay, so this is an anti-God campaign. Remember, who does Pharaoh think is God?
Himself.
Plus is the pantheon, right? But he also believes himself. Okay, verse 14 really emphasizes Israel's desperate need for deliverance, right? I mean, their lives are bitter. Hard labor, okay, all kinds of labor, all their labors rigorously imposed, right? Again, Moses emphasizing over and over again that their lives are now miserable, okay? Part of the reason we need to really understand this is you do not fully appreciate your deliverance or your salvation unless you know exactly what it is you are saved from, okay? So their lives are absolutely miserable. They're treated awfully as slaves, and this is what God delivers them from, which then you'd think they would be grateful, but they weren't. Right, but the lesson, I mean, really is for us, right? If we need to truly understand the depravity of our sin in order to fully appreciate our own salvation, and we can be just as foolish as the Israelites and yearn for the days before we were saved when, oh, well, you know, then I was free to do whatever I wanted, okay? This word that's used for, is translated labor, okay? In Hebrew, it's abad, A-B-A-D, okay? And it means to work, to serve, or to labor, to be under the control of, okay? Which is why they translated it labor. But what's interesting about this word is later in the book of Exodus, this word is applied to Israel's relationship to God. Okay? So they are delivered from labor to be under the control of, work, serve of the Egyptians to be labor under the control of, work, serve God. Okay? And we talked about this last time too. It is not that God delivered them to be absolutely free and now they can do whatever they want. No. And the New Testament talks about this too. We go from being slaves to sin to slaves to righteousness. They go from being slaves to Pharaoh to slaves to God. Okay? So this, like we talked about in our introduction, Exodus is the cornerstone of theology, and we get the beginning of ideas of a lot of our theology in the book of Exodus. And this would be part of what we call lordship salvation, right? That when we are saved, we are not free now to just do whatever we want. We now have to obey God. We were slaves to sin, now we're slaves to righteousness. Okay, that idea is introduced and established in the book of Exodus. Okay, we have to be under the control of God. Questions? 10 to 14, 8 to 14.
I just, mm-hmm. back up. Yep. You said, I just missed the years. You said they went from 70 men to 200,000.
600,000.
Okay, 600,000. And how many years?
430. Because they're in Egypt 430 years.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's just men. Yeah. So they extrapolate it out, and it's approximately 2 million.
Right.
Okay, with 600,000. Good. Anything else? All right. Can someone read for me verses 15 to 22?
Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shaphara, and the other was named
Pua.
Pua. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birthstool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? The midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive.
Okay, so now we're going to see phase three, right? Phase one, or round one, of oppression was just hard labor. Phase two is slaves. Now phase three is infanticide. Okay, now we're just going to... Hard work, slavery, nothing works, so now we're just going to straight out kill them. Okay? So, now, remember, verse 15. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other was named Pua. Okay, back to verse 1. What is the name of the book of Exodus in Hebrew?
Book of Names.
Names. Who is named in verse 15 and who is not named in verse 15?
The king of Egypt is not.
The king of Egypt is not named. And who is named?
The midwives.
The midwives, okay? In the Hebrew, the emphasis is on the names of the midwives. I think it's literally spoke to the Hebrew midwives, the name of one was Shifra and the name of the other. It's the emphasis is these are their names. Now, these are midwives. These are lowly Jewish midwives. Right? They're not important. They're not powerful. They're nothing. Okay? And here, Pharaoh of Egypt is not given a name, but God specifically names the midwives. Okay? This should remind us back to Genesis 11. When they built the Tower of Babel, what did they want? Let us build a tower and create a name for ourselves. Okay? Genesis 11, they wanted a name for themselves. God does not give them a name. In chapter 12, who does God name? Do you remember? I will create a name for you. Abraham. God names who he names. We try to create a name for ourselves. That's not going to work out so well. Okay? But God is the one who chooses who is going to have a name. And here, these two lowly midwives, their names are recorded for all of eternity. And yet, Scripture never names the pharaohs. Why? Because they're not important. Because God is going to use the lowly midwives to show up all-powerful Pharaoh. Okay? So names are very important in the book of Exodus. Okay? God is going to use these nobodies. They're women, right? And in this society, you have to remember. We're going to see all throughout Exodus 1 and 2, it is women that take a stand against Almighty Pharaoh, all right? And women are lowly. Women are not important. Women are not powerful, all right? But it is the women, and here they have a name, and Pharaoh does not, okay? God is going to use these nobodies, these lowly midwives, to beat Satan, Okay? Remember always, Satan tries and God wins. You know, over and over, God wins. I mean, even in Exodus 1, we see God winning already over and over. Okay, also, because the midwives are named from verse 15, we should read the rest of the chapter in that God has created a name for them, so whatever they do is going to show God's victory. Okay, because we're going to run into a problem. Did they lie? Did they not? Did God bless them for a lie? What happened, right? Okay, remember, God has already named them from verse 15. So their actions are going to be a showcase of God's victory over Pharaoh throughout the rest of the chapter. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. All right. So everything Pharaoh does is going to show that he fails, and everything that the midwives do is going to show that God wins. Okay, now, there would not have only been two midwives, right, to service, right? So these might have been, I don't know if they had their own, you know, grouping. These might have been the two midwife leaders. These might just have been two of the midwives. We're not sure. But for, you know, a whole population, there's going to be more than just two midwives. They might have been the senior ones, okay? It says the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. Okay, this can be translated communicated to or gave instruction for. So he might have summoned them before him because he wants to intimidate them into doing what he wants them to do, which is kill babies. Or he might have just sent a messenger. We're not sure. Okay? But either way, his message is communicated. Okay? In verse 16, and he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. Okay? So he is asking them to kill babies, right? As soon as they can tell if it's a girl or a boy, if it's a boy, they're just supposed to kill him. Okay? Pharaoh is trying to assert his power, and he's Pharaoh. He thinks he's a god, right? So he fully expects to be obeyed, to be listened to and be obeyed. He expects midwives. I mean, and these are Hebrew midwives. But he expects that he is so powerful that they will willingly kill their own people, kill their own baby boys. Most likely, there was a whole deal. You know, do this and you'll get some sort of reward. Don't do it and most likely I'll kill you, right? I mean, I'm sure he wasn't so foolish just to think that his influence could make them do it willingly, right? There probably was some threat to their own safety to compel them to kill baby boys. Okay. Obviously, Pharaoh wants to kill boys because boys can fight in the military, boys can be more of a threat. Women tend to be, especially in this culture, dependent on men. So if there are no men, then the women are also going to fail as well. This is a long-term population control, right? He is not telling people to go out and kill all the boys that are alive. No, this is a certain point in time, and we're just going to kill baby boys from born this point forward, okay? So that's not going to have a real effect on the population for a while. I mean, yes, boys are gone, but it's not going to affect the women until later down the road, okay? So this is a long-term population control, okay? Also, I don't know what he thought. Like, are the mothers just going to let, you know, maybe he thought that the midwives could secretly kill the baby, so then all of a sudden all the baby boys just happen to be stillborn. But it seems like there's some level of secrecy here, right? The midwives are to do it and maybe not let the moms know. How he thought that would work out, I don't know. But maybe he thought he's Pharaoh, so what he says gets done. Okay. Verse 17. But the midwives feared God. Okay, this is the first time God is mentioned in the book of Exodus. And did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. Okay? Pharaoh picked his murderers poorly because the ones he picked, they fear God. We don't know exactly what they knew about God, right? Remember, they have no scripture. Moses writes Genesis and, you know, possibly the book of Job was around, right? Job probably lived around the time of Jacob, so maybe the book of Job was around. But remember, they don't have necessarily a lot of knowledge of God other than what's been passed down, okay? And we're going to see that this generation that leaves Egypt is not a good generation, right? So what is their real knowledge of God? We don't know. But the midwives at least know that there is a God higher than Pharaoh who determines what's right and wrong. And this is wrong. And so even though Pharaoh sets himself up to be God, we are going to obey God, and not Pharaoh, okay? Because they at least had some knowledge that their God was more powerful than Pharaoh, or at least, you know, determined what was right and wrong, and Pharaoh did not. Okay. Okay. Here it's pointed out specifically that it's the midwives that fear God. And like I said, we're going to see that that is not necessarily typical of this generation that leaves Egypt. Okay. So by the time we get to Exodus 32, which is the golden calf, we should not be surprised at what they do. Because it seems that those who fear God among this generation are few in number. Okay? And so by the time we get to Exodus 32, it's like golden calf. Well, we, you know, to be expected. Especially when the generation complains like 2 days out, right? We're going to die. You should have just left us be. Okay, so it says that they did not do, but they let the boys live, okay? So by their actions, they oppose Pharaoh. Remember, lowly women, not important women, yet God has given them a name to shame all-powerful Pharaoh, and by their actions, they defy Pharaoh, okay? Their fear of God has been translated into action, right? Their beliefs make a difference in what they do. And I'm sure Pharaoh threatened them. You know, they knew that they were taking their lives in their hands probably by obeying God and not Pharaoh. Verse 18. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?" Now, most likely years have passed by this point, right? Because it's not going to be immediately obvious. Back in this day, baby boys, baby girls probably dressed the same. Even when they're dressed different, I mean, people mistake your baby for the opposite gender. I've had it happen to both my babies, right? People have thought Abby was a boy and John a girl. So, you know, babies, you don't know. It's hard to tell, okay? So it's probably not for years until Pharaoh's like, hey, there's just as many little boys running around as there are little girls running around in the Jewish communities. What's going on? Okay, so this isn't, you know, he gives them this command and 6 months later he calls them in for accounting. This is probably years and years have gone by before there's a significant difference, right? And even with the midwives trying to kill all the baby boys, there are going to be baby boys that slip through, you know. So it's going to be a while before Pharaoh can tell. Obviously, Pharaoh is angry. His stated will has been clearly defied, right? And it's possible that when he calls them before him, this is the examination before their execution, you know. Hey, you have not obeyed me, and so I'm going to carry out my threat. All right? Verse 19, the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them." Okay, so now here is the problem, right? I don't know if you've run into this before, but commonly it says, well, are they lying? Okay, do the midwives lie? And then does God bless them for it? And how do we reconcile that theologically? Because obviously lying is a sin. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about. First, let's look at what the midwives say, okay? They say, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, okay? In the Hebrew, not as the Egyptian women is first, okay? So that's where the emphasis is. So basically, it's a slam on the Egyptian women, all right? Your women are weak. Our women are strong. Okay, we're not like you. You need all this help giving birth. our women are vigorous and just pop babies out, okay, with no problem. Okay, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them. Okay, that word vigorous means full of life. Okay, so basically they're saying that the Hebrew women exceed the Egyptian women. Right? Now remember, what is God doing with the Jews? Multiplying them, right? They are fruitful and multiplying. Okay, so there is nothing that Pharaoh can do to stop them. He's tried. He has tried hard labor. He has tried slavery. Now he is trying infanticide. And every single time, what happens? They're fruitful and multiply. They're fruitful and multiply. They just keep multiplying. Okay? So he cannot do, he is trying hard, but again, he fails, God wins. Okay? So even in their answer, there's a slam on Egyptian women. All right? Your women are weak and need lots of help. Our women just pop babies out, no problem. Okay, so here's the key in verse 20. Did the midwives lie or not? Verse 20. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Now in the English, that so sounds like a conclusion. Because of this, therefore this. Because they said this, that the Hebrews pop out babies vigorously, then God blesses, or God is good to them. Okay? In the Hebrew, that so is not a result. It is a summary of what has just been stated. It's another way of saying what has already been said. Okay? So they say the Hebrew women are not as Egyptian women. They pop out babies. They're vigorous. Okay? Verse 20. In summary, God is good to them. In other words, they did not lie. God was good to them. How was he good to them? He was good to them in that they didn't have to make awful decisions, right? The Hebrew women really did have babies fast. God enabled them to have their babies so the midwives could just come and help and do their thing, and they didn't have to say, hey, let's kill, let's not kill. All right? So that so is not a result. It's a summary of what has already occurred. Exactly. Right.
In their labor process. And so he made it.
Yep.
Because he wanted them to multiply. So
exactly.
He let them have babies faster.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. Because remember, this is God brought them to Egypt to make them into a nation.
It would have been a good time to have babies.
It would have been a great time to have babies. Just pop them out. And nothing Pharaoh can do is going to stop God from doing what he's going to do. Okay? Right? It says the people multiplied and became very mighty. Okay? So multiplied, again, this is exactly what Pharaoh is trying to stop them doing. And yet they constantly, fruitful and multiplied, fruitful and multiplied. Again, he loses. God wins. Okay? Again, they're said to be mighty. Okay, back to verse 7 and verse 9, right? They're said to be mighty again. This is exactly what Pharaoh's afraid of, that they're going to be mighty. Nothing he can do can stop the growth of God's people. Okay? Then, verse 21, because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. This is the result. Verse 20 is not the result. Verse 21 is the result. Okay, that because in Hebrew it says, and it came to pass. Okay, so they get households. All right, because they are faithful, they fear God, he gives them households. This ties back to verse 1, where it says, now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household. Okay, and remember, the goal of being in Egypt is to grow into a nation, to have a household, that each person that comes is going to create a very big household, right? And pass it on down the line. So these midwives are blessed, and the way they are blessed is that they get households of their own. It implies that it was unusual for a midwife to have a household, okay? Possibly couple of options. Maybe midwives typically were barren women, right? Because if you're a midwife, you need to be free at all hours of the day to attend a birth at all hours of the day. If you have a family of your own, that's a little hard to do, okay? Or they might have been older, right? Unable to have babies anymore, right? And now God has given them households of their own. Okay, so he has blessed them because of their faithfulness. Okay, verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. All right? Round four. Okay, hard labor doesn't work. Slavery doesn't work. Getting the Hebrew midwives to kill babies doesn't work. So now we're just going to recruit all the Egyptians to kill babies. Okay? So infanticide 2.0. Now we're just going to throw them in the Nile. And now everyone is responsible. Okay? Doing it secretly, having the Hebrew midwives try to kill the babies right as soon as they're born. That didn't work. Okay, so now you see a baby boy, you just throw him in the Nile. Okay? So he wants to involve all the Egyptians, and we're going to see he doesn't even have power over his own people. Ironically, he doesn't even have power over who? His own daughter. Okay? Yeah. Okay, so Pharaoh is planning large-scale genocide. Okay, why the Nile? Probably a couple reasons. It's an easy, fast way to kill a baby. I mean, it's not messy, no cleanup. Throw them in the river, they drown, the river just sweeps them away. Okay. Two, what did they believe about the Nile?
It was a god.
Okay, so maybe the Egyptians could even justify it to themselves that, hey, I'm not really killing a god is killing the baby, you know. If the Nile, if the god wants the baby to live, then the baby will survive. You know, I'll just throw him in and then it's up to the Nile to decide, okay. But then it's going to be ironic that his own daughter doesn't obey him. And not only does his own daughter not obey him, who does his own daughter save? A Hebrew, but who is he?
Moses.
Who then does what? Right? His own daughter defies him to save the man who is going to be the deliverer. Okay? So again, God wins. Through all of chapter 1, Pharaoh tries to scheme and God wins.
Pharaoh's plan is very short, though. He has all these little ideas. Mm-hmm. He can't follow through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting to me that he's a pharaoh and he doesn't kind of...
Okay, but we also have to remember that these are multiple pharaohs.
That's right.
Okay, so it's probably Moses who starts with the pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. Yeah. Okay, and then you have Amenhotep the first, Thutmose the first, and Thutmose the second. Wait just a second. Okay, so it was probably... Okay, so you have Amosis, Amenhotep the first. It was probably Thutmose the first that wants the babies dead.
Okay, you have that in your notes.
Yes, okay. So that's three pharaohs in.
You mean round four?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's either round three or round four.
To kill babies.
The midwives.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Thutmose
the second is probably Moses's... half brother.
Okay,
and then it's going to be Thutmose the third that's the pharaoh of the Exodus.
Right.
Okay, so
there's three of them, but they pass the
block. Yes. So they're all trying to control this population. They're all afraid of Israel. Okay, but who does exactly what, we're not sure. But
it's interesting, they're all the same
page. Well, I mean, you have this, I mean, going from one pharaoh to the next, right, generation to generation, Israel just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, so they become more and more of a threat. If Moses thinks they're a threat, right, by the time you get to Thutmose the second, right, they're already now a huge threat because they're so much bigger than they were.
I think that's part of why the lie wasn't as, like, God was condemning it. Obviously, they were obeying him, which was the bigger picture.
But the Israelites had stayed in Goshen,
mm-hmm.
had stayed separate, and their laws and their beliefs were different.
Right.
So I think Israel still had maintained
yes.
a certain amount of knowledge of right and wrong. So to not to go ahead and lie to Pharaoh was not like a sin like we would categorize.
Right.
They were still doing what was right. Maybe they never even considered.
Right.
Because it was a totally different religion and set of rules that they were
right.
disobeying.
Right. No, they were separate. But we are going to see, I mean, they still, they don't have the correct view of God that they should. But again, remember, they didn't have a lot of revelation either.
But passing down
yes.
was their way of
yes, exactly.
So if they'd have paid attention at
yes.
all, that was
right.
the tradition.
Right, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Good. Any questions, chapter one? Okay, we'll keep going. Chapter 2, can someone read for me verse 1 to 10?
Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a wicker basket and covered it with tar and pitch. And she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, and her maidens walking alongside the Nile, and she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child. And behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from among the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went in and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, and said, "Because I drew him out of the water."
Okay, so these verses, 1 to 10, are in a chiasm, C-H-I-A-S-M, which means you have, it goes like A, B, C, B, A, okay? So we have the mom, Jochebed, Miriam the sister, Pharaoh's daughter, then Miriam, and then Jochebed again. Okay, the mom. So we go mom, sister, Pharaoh's daughter, sister, mom. And when you have that kind of structure in scripture, the emphasis is on whatever's in the middle. Okay, and so it's Pharaoh's daughter that is in the middle. She's going to be the emphasis because it's what she does, right? God uses what she does or has planned what she did to basically change the outcome of the nation of Israel, right? It was Moses that she saved, and it was because of her actions that the deliverer is raised up. Okay, it's the turning, this is the turning point of Israel's fortunes. Okay, we're going to see again, Pharaoh loses because of his own daughter, right? And this is why we think that possibly this is Hatshepsut, okay, or however you say her name, because she had enough chutzpah, right, to defy her father. She tried to rule Egypt herself. She tried to be Pharaoh. Okay, so it could have been her that, you know, had enough guts to defy her own father in this matter.
Isn't it interesting that at no time did she ever think about doing away with that?
Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Good. All right, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. Okay, so remember, this is before the law has been given. All right, it's going to be given later in Exodus. This is before that Levi was chosen to be the tribe of priests, which is also going to happen in the book of Exodus. Okay, but before that, Moses is born into the tribe of Levi from both mom and dad. Okay, he's fully of the tribe of Levi. God is already setting up his role and the role of this tribe, even from Moses' birth. The tribe of Levi is going to be the spiritual leaders of Israel. So Moses is qualified in this even from his birth. He comes from the right tribe. Obviously, that's all God's orchestration, right? That Moses is going to be from the tribe that God chooses to be the spiritual leaders of Israel. Okay? Remember, the original readers of Exodus or hearers of Exodus would have known this, okay? Because it was during their lifetime that the Levites were chosen to be the priests. Okay? Verse 2, the woman conceived and bore a son. This phrase, conceived and bore a son, is unique. It's different than, you know, just had a baby. It's used in Genesis to mark important births. Okay? And it ties back to Genesis 3. All right? Do you remember Genesis 3 is the curses, the fall and the curses? But if you can remember all the way back over a year ago, when we studied Genesis 3, in each curse, there is an element of hope. Do we remember that? In each curse, there's an element of hope. In the curse of the serpent, we get Genesis 3:15, key to the whole Bible, right? That there's coming a seed that's going to crush Satan's head. Do we remember what the element of hope in Eve's curse was, in the woman's curse? Okay, yes. It's that God was going to increase her pain, was the curse, but he was also going to increase what? Her conception, her ability to conceive, right? So you're going to have a lot of pain in childbirth, but the hope is you are going to be able to conceive. The son is coming. The seed is coming, right? And then she thought it was Cain, and that was a disaster. But so here, conceived and bore a son, should put in your head that phrase, should remind you back to Genesis 3. Yes, we're looking for a seed. Okay, so in the book of Genesis, this phrase, conceived to bore a son, is used, Genesis 21:2, for Isaac. Right? Line of the seed. She conceived, Sarah finally, right, conceives and bears a son. It's also Genesis 29, verse 32 to 35. For the first four sons of Leah, okay, which Judah is going to be the line of the seed. And then in Genesis 30, for the rest of Jacob's sons, right? All of Jacob's sons are important because they're going to be the ones, the tribes of Israel. All right? This is the last time that Moses uses this phrase, conceived and bore a son, and he uses it for his own birth. Okay? His birth is important, because he is going to be the deliverer of Egypt, of Israel, and he is going to be the precursor to who? Christ. To Christ, right? And we've talked about before how Christ's life mirrors Moses' life. They have a lot of parallels because we needed a second Moses. Why? We need a spiritual Exodus. Moses gave them the physical exodus. They need a spiritual exodus. So he is going to be a type of Christ, the precursor to Christ. So his birth is very important. And so the last time Moses uses this phrase is for his own birth. Okay. Let's turn to Hebrews 11. And can someone read for me verse 23? Okay, so Hebrews 11 credits the hiding of him to both his parents, okay, mom and dad. Okay, in Exodus, it sounds like it's all just his mom, but obviously dad would have had to vent on it too. So Hebrews 11 tells us mom and dad are involved. Exodus 2 and 3 just says, but when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months, but when she could hide him no longer. So the emphasis is on the mom, but obviously she's going to be doing most of the work of hiding because dad's going to be off working, doing whatever he has to do, and she's going to be the one probably home with the kids. Okay. So Moses here in Exodus is crediting his mother for doing everything that she could do to keep him alive. Okay. She hides him for 3 months. We've all had babies or known babies, right? First 3 months, what do? They sleep most of the time, right? So it's easier to hide a baby when all they do is sleep and eat, and that's basically all they do. But when they get, as they get older, they're awake more, they want to wiggle more, they're louder, it becomes more difficult to hide. Okay, so that's why she hides him for the first 3 months, and then she has to do something different because it's not going to work to just hide him. It's going to be, he's going to be harder to hide.
It would feel so strange to be writing about yourself in this way.
Yeah.
Like the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw he was a fine child.
Right, but remember, he was beautiful enough that Pharaoh's daughter wanted him. You know, he was probably a pretty cute baby. Verse 3, it says, but when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Okay, just store this in the back of your brain. We're going to talk about it in a little bit. When it says she got him a wicker basket, that got is literally take or took. She took for him a wicker basket. Okay? Does anyone know what the wicker basket, what the real term is in Hebrew? Literal term is in Hebrew?
Ark.
Yes, it's the ark.
Yeah.
It's the same word that's used for Noah's ark. Okay? So Noah is in a huge ark, and Moses is in an itty-bitty baby ark. Okay? But the link is there. Okay? Noah delivers the earth, right? He's the only, all of mankind, he is the only righteous one, him and his family. He saves all the animals. God starts over with him. Okay? Moses now is going to deliver the nation of Israel. Okay? So God saved Noah through his ginormous ark. God is going to save Moses through his little itty-bitty ark. But the word is the same. Okay? This ark is made of papyrus. Okay, and Jochebed, or his mother, seals it, right? Probably just to try to make it waterproof. Okay, she's doing her best to save, doing what she can to save her baby. Scripture doesn't tell us, hey, this was a genius idea, or this was the stupidest thing she could have ever done. It just tells us, you know, you just see a mom trying really hard to save her baby. Okay, then she put her child into it, into the ark, and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. Okay, so the ark with Moses in it is placed in the reeds. Okay, so this is near the shore where it's not going to float far. Okay, Moses doesn't go riding down the Nile in his ark. All right, she doesn't place him in the middle in the current. She places him in the reeds by the side. One of the commentators I read thinks that she did this so that during the day when the Egyptians are around, right, he is hidden. He's somewhere public where there's maybe other noises. So if he cries, maybe he won't be heard as well. We see that his sister stands and watches him. Maybe Jochebed can steal away and feed him when he's hungry. And then at night, she can take him home when there's less chance of being discovered. That's what he thought. Okay, so it's possible. We don't know. I mean, I think a lot of times we grow up thinking she puts him in the Nile, like, peace out. Hope everything goes well. Well, that would be, in essence, killing your baby, right? So it's probably she's trying to hide him somewhere where maybe she still has access and can try to keep him alive as long as possible.
Okay. And the reeds, if they're very thick,
right,
it's not going to go anywhere.
Exactly.
Plus, you can't see it.
Right, right.
You know.
It would be hidden.
Yeah.
Yes, right. And Miriam is sent to watch, right? So it's not like this ark is going, you know, where she has to go running down the Nile River. No, she can stand in one spot and watch. Okay? He's set among the reeds. This is going to be important. In Exodus 13:18, when they're going to cross, in our translations, it says the Red Sea. Okay? In Hebrew, it is literally the Reed Sea. Okay? Exodus 13:18. They're going to cross. Remember, they've left Egypt. Pharaoh's chasing them. Okay? And they're backed up against the Red Sea, is what our translations say. In Hebrew, it is literally the Reed Sea. Okay? So, do we remember corporate solidarity? Do we remember what that is?
The one for the many.
In Israel, we are going to see over and over again that their leader experiences first, or what the many are going to experience later, or suffers first for what the many are going to suffer later. Okay? So here, Moses is delivered from his own reeds, right? When God later is going to deliver the entire nation from their own reeds. Okay, so Moses is delivered, then the nation is delivered. Okay, the one for the many. And who is the ultimate one for the many? Christ, right? Christ's sacrifice, what he did on the cross, can pay for our sins. And we're going to see all throughout Moses' life, especially in Exodus 3, when God reveals himself to Moses, he is giving Moses a picture of what he wants for the entire nation. God tells one first to be the example for what he wants for the whole nation, for everybody. Okay, corporate solidarity. Okay, this is how God raises up deliverers. This is what we're going to see throughout the Old Testament, throughout Scripture. This is how God works. Okay. Verse 4, his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Okay, this is Miriam, but we don't find out her name until chapter 15, verse 20. Okay. But the whole family is involved in saving Moses, right? It was mom and dad, Hebrews 11, trying to hide him. Here we have Miriam. We know Aaron is only 3 at this point, right? He's 3 years older. When they stand before Pharaoh, it says Aaron is 83 and Moses is 80. Okay, so we know Aaron is 3 years older. So that makes Miriam the oldest. Okay, we don't know how old she is, but she is old enough to have responsibility to stand and watch, and also gutsy enough to approach Pharaoh's daughter. Okay, so we're not exactly sure how old she is, but probably at least 6, if not even older than that. Okay, to have.
Yep. So she's like obeying the rules, kind of. But more seriously, do you think she had any sense that you know, or any knowledge that Pharaoh and her, or Pharaoh's daughter and the maidens came down there, right? And they were near enough that they could find it, or anything like that? Or
my guess would be no, just because Pharaoh ordered everyone to throw baby boys in the Nile. If anyone's going to obey Pharaoh, who would you think logically would obey Pharaoh? His own family or his daughter, right? You would think. Obviously, God works differently, right? But we don't know. But I wouldn't imagine. I think Jochebed was just trying to save her baby. She was just doing what she could. There was no idea of, hey, maybe he'll be adopted by some kind Egyptian. Right. Exactly. One day, at least he's alive today. At least he's alive today, you know? I mean, I just think as a mom, and this is the edict, you're just going to do whatever you can to try to. Right, exactly. To try to save your baby. Yeah. And you would think that if anyone's going to throw him in the Nile, it would be Pharaoh's daughter, right? Because she would obey her dad, you would think. Okay, so Miriam is standing at attention where it says stood at a distance. That stood means stand at attention. Okay, so she is watching diligently. This is her focus. This is her job. You know, mom has said, you watch that ark. Don't let it out of your sight. Probably. Okay, it says she's going to find out what would happen to him. Okay, so she doesn't know what's going to happen to him. Now, we don't know. Is this day one that Jochebed put him in the ark? Is this day 20? You know, we don't know. Maybe it was the first day and Miriam's watching to see, is anyone going to find out what my mom has done? Is anyone going to discover the ark, and is Moses going to be dead? Okay, we don't know. Verse 5 and 6, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Okay? So, most likely, Jochebed would have hid Moses where he was least likely to be found. You know, among the reeds, try to hide it as much as possible. Okay? But he is found. Okay? And him being found should have led to his death. Right? A good Egyptian should have obeyed their God and found a Hebrew child and just tossed him in the Nile. Okay? Take him out of the ark, toss him in the Nile. That's what should have happened. But it didn't. Instead, his being found led to his perfect protection. Right? My goodness, adopted into the household of Pharaoh himself. Okay? It says the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe the Nile. Everyone went down to the Nile. It was downhill. Right? They would have lived on higher ground to stay away from the flooding of the Nile. So they would have gone down to the Nile. Just like everybody goes up to Jerusalem, regardless of what direction you come from, because it is up in elevation. Okay, same idea. Remember, the Nile is sacred. That's probably why the princess came to bathe in the Nile instead of just having water, you know, brought for her in the palace or whatever. Okay, maybe this was some sort of religious something, or maybe it was just good luck to bathe in the Nile, but for whatever reason, the princess comes down to bathe. If you read it carefully, she is in the Nile, and her maids are on the shore, right? She came down to bathe the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile, okay? So she has her entourage. She's in the water taking a bath. Her maids are all just standing guard or there to help her, whatever she needs on the shore, okay? The princess, sees the ark, okay? Possibly he's, okay, so Moses is crying when she opens it. Maybe that's what helped her notice it. Maybe she heard him first and then was kind of looking and then saw the ark amongst the reeds. We're not sure, but she sends her maid to get it. Probably because the ark is near the shore. Remember, her maids are on the shore. And the ark is amongst the reeds, so it's probably easily reached from the shore. And, you know, she's out in the middle-ish, I mean, whatever, away from the reeds so she can actually get a bath. Okay, when it says, end of verse 5, and sent her maid, the princess sent her maid, what's interesting is that sent is the same word as cast in 1 verse 22, if you just look up. Pharaoh says, you are to cast into the Nile. Okay, every boy, every son, you are, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile. When, the princess sends her maid, she is casting her maid. All right, so what's ironic is Pharaoh says, cast the babies into the Nile. What does the princess do? Instead of casting Moses into the Nile, she casts her maid into the Nile to get the baby to save him. Okay, so it goes againstly. Again, we see God wins, Pharaoh loses. Okay. Moses is crying. And how does the princess respond? She has pity. Or compassion. This is the exact opposite of what Pharaoh wants, right? He does not want his people to have compassion. He wants his people to be so afraid of the Jews that they're willing to kill helpless babies, okay? She says, this is one of the Hebrews' children, all right? So she knows right away. Possibly because who else would hide their baby among the reeds? Like, just because of the situation? Possibly because of the way he's dressed, or maybe physical features are different? Possibly she checks and sees that he's circumcised. Okay, I mean, there are a bunch of different ways she could have known that was a Hebrew. But from the beginning, she knows who this is and she knows what she's doing. It's not, oh, this poor baby needs my help, I take him in. Oh, 10 days later, I figure out he's a Hebrew. No. She knows from the get-go.
How did she keep her maids quiet?
I don't know that they were quiet. I think Pharaoh knew.
Oh, you think Pharaoh knew?
Yeah. Well, okay. Maybe not right away, because she gets a wet nurse. And so who does Moses live for the first 3 or 4 years of his life? His own family, okay? But Pharaoh had to know, I mean, obviously there was some sort of protection on Moses so that some other random Egyptian wouldn't throw him in the Nile. Okay. But remember, Pharaoh is very angry, which then is Moses' half-brother or step-brother, whatever, when Moses kills the Egyptian, right? Why? Because Moses is a Hebrew. So I think it was known that he was a Hebrew. It wasn't kept quiet. But again, if the princess is bold enough to adopt him, maybe Pharaoh was just like, fine, it's my daughter's whims or whatever. It's one, exactly. I don't know. But I don't know if there was a need to keep the maids quiet.
Well, obviously he lived there because she dropped him off.
Yes.
You know, and so they're probably all together.
Well, no, he would have lived at home until he was weaned.
No, I meant when the mom took him, when his real mom took him up to the palace and dropped him off.
Right, after he's weaned. Yeah, yeah, so then from 4, 3, 4, whatever on, he would have lived at the palace.
See this kid running around.
Yeah.
And go, what's he doing?
Oops. Yeah. But see, by the time, if he didn't know until he was weaned, which I don't know, right, then by that point, he's too old to be killed.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're supposed to throw infants.
Daughter,
right.
She's now saying, this is my son.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so he's probably like,
oh, whatever. Yeah.
It's so ironic that
yes.
He orders these baby boys to be thrown into the Nile. His own daughter pulls out of
yes.
the Nile and raises him in the
yes.
palace.
Yes. With Pharaoh. God has a sense of humor. Satan, you think you're going to try this? Ha ha, watch this.
Well, it shows that God can change. Maybe he didn't change his mind, obviously, but he does something to his mind to let him have her have the kid.
Right, allow her to keep the kid.
You know,
yeah.
It's kind of like, well, it's kind of back with the babies, the whole baby thing. When the midwife said, yeah, well, they have the baby so fast that
yeah.
they can't get there in time.
It's Pharaoh's like okay.
That's what I mean. Looking at a forward plan. Well, okay, all right, whatever. But God does that.
Right.
You know, it's showing that God.
Right, God is the one.
And all that stuff, which
yeah.
does a whole bunch of stuff.
But doesn't. Okay. All right. So back to. The baby is Hebrew, right? So she knows from the get-go she's defying her father. Okay? And so she is a woman in a long list of women who have defied Pharaoh, right? First the midwives, then Jochebed herself, right? Just a mom trying to keep her baby alive, and now his own daughter. All right? Long list of women defying Pharaoh. Don't tell me the Bible is anti-women, right? Read the book of Exodus. Woman power, right? I'm joking. But yes, God uses women as well. And he uses what society views as the lesser to bring down the mighty. Okay. Verse 7 and 8. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women? Okay. So Miriam approaches, right? I mean, poor Miriam. She must have had a heart attack when they found the ark. Right? But then, instead of running away, she approaches Pharaoh's daughter, right? She offers to find a wet nurse, okay? She is implying, even by her question, shall I go and call a nurse for you? She is implying that Pharaoh's daughter is going to keep the baby, okay? So possibly she had said something to indicate, oh, I want to keep the baby, maybe something like that. Maybe Miriam was just trying to say, keep the baby. Yeah, he's so cute. Exactly. Okay. But when Pharaoh's daughter in verse 8 says, go, right, mm-hmm. Moses' protection is assured. It's at that point she has decided to keep this baby. I need a wet nurse. Obviously, she didn't just have a baby. She can't nurse the baby. There is no formula, right? If you don't have a wet nurse, your baby dies. So Moses is going to be protected from this day forward. Okay, so we don't know how Jochebed felt about all of this. Verse then to verse 8, so the girl went and called the child's mother. Okay. But now she can openly care for her son, and God has totally reversed the situation towards hope and salvation. She had come up with this crack-brained scheme of hiding him in the Nile in this little ark, and now she can keep her baby out in the open, and it's not going to be a problem. Her baby is safe. God has turned the situation, I'm sure, of being scared every minute of every day, wondering what's going to happen to your baby, to, you know, peace and comfort and hope, you know, my baby will live. Verse 9 and 10, then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. And she exactly. She gets to care for her baby in the open, gets to nurse her baby, and she gets to be paid for it. So she's being provided for. Moses is being provided for. God has totally reversed this situation of what Pharaoh wanted to be death and destruction, right? God is turning around. Okay, remember in verse 3 where it said she got him a wicker basket. It was she took for him a wicker basket. Here now in verse 9, Pharaoh says, take this child, and she took him. Jochebed took the child, right? So here we see a reversal as well. Verse 3, she's taking a wicker basket in a desperate act to try to save her baby. Now she can take her baby openly and care for her baby openly, and there is no more fear. God has turned the situation around, okay? From, you know, hardly any hope at all to now I know my baby will be fine. I will even get paid to take care of my own baby. Okay. Pharaoh's daughter clearly did not fear her father, seems like, right? Didn't fear her father's edict or any recrimination. It seems like she wasn't worried about any consequences of Pharaoh saying, oh, no, you don't, and Pharaoh himself taking the baby and throwing it in the Nile. It doesn't seem like that. She has everything arranged before she even leaves her bath. All right? She's in her bath, finds the baby, spur of the moment, decides to keep the baby. Before she even leaves the Nile, Jochebed has come, and she says, take the baby, nurse him, and I'll even pay you. It's like done. The whole thing is set up and done before she even leaves the Nile. Okay? Clearly, this is why people think it's Hatshepsut, because she, you know, maybe she was such a strong-willed daughter that Pharaoh was just like, I'm just not even touching you. Okay? It's possible. Verse 10, the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Okay? So children were nursed 3 to 4 years back then. All right, so it wouldn't have been until he was weaned that he would have gone to the palace, right? A wet nurse implies that the mom has had a baby, so she has her own family to take care of. So it's not like Jochebed could have gone to the palace to live with Pharaoh's daughter to nurse. I mean, she could have, because Moses was her baby, but Moses would have lived with his family until he was 3 or 4, and then he would have been taken to the palace to live with them. Okay.
I can't imagine 3 or 4 year old, like, you know, Abby, like,
yeah,
age, and then sending them off to live somewhere, yeah, else.
But what's interesting is during the Exodus, Aaron and Miriam do not seem to be strangers to Moses, right? God says, your brother Aaron is on his way to meet you. And it's not like Moses is like, who? I have a brother. So there's, it seems like there was some sort of, even when he was at the palace, as he grew up, there was, it appears that there was some sort of contact with his family, that he knew something about his family. I mean, and he knew growing up that he was a Hebrew, right? Because it says he sees, just in the next couple of verses, he sees his brethren. He knows he's not Egyptian. He knows he's Hebrew. Okay. His name, Moses, means to draw out. Okay. So his name is one of deliverance. It shows how God saved him. He was drawn out of the water. So he is going to be the deliverer of Israel, and even his name shows how God delivered him personally.